Welcome to Lecture 18, Social Stars, Binaries and Clusters. In the previous lecture, we found how to determine the distances of nearby stars. The idea was based on trigonometric parallax, or triangulation, the same way in which you determine the distance of your finger by closing one eye and then the other and seeing how much in angle the finger shifts from one position to another relative to the distant background of objects. Knowing the spacing between your eye and measuring the amount of the shift gives you the distance by solving a simple triangle. This method of triangulation was very important in the early history of astronomy and still is very important because the distances of stars are a fundamental aspect of them. We need to know their distances in order to determine how powerful they are, where they are, how they're moving, things like that. So I'd like to read you something from Octaves 11 by Edwin Arlington Robinson. He wrote, "And thus we die, still searching like poor old astronomers who totter off to bed and go to sleep to dream of untriangulated stars." So, triangulation, important technique. From the distances of stars and their apparent brightnesses, we determine their intrinsic power, their luminosity. And then we saw how early in this century, Hertzsprung and Russell plotted the luminosity or intrinsic power of a star versus its spectral class or temperature, which we got from the peak of the spectrum or from an analysis of the absorption lines. And they found that stars occupy, in most cases, a diagonal path along this diagram from the very hot, very powerful ones to the cool, dim ones. All right? Most stars are these so-called main sequence stars, or dwarfs. But there are also clumps of stars up here called giants. They're very big, we saw. And then the supergiants are enormous stars, encompassing in some cases the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, if they had planetary systems comparable to our own. And then there are the white dwarfs, little tiny stars, about the size of the Earth. We will see later that these various classes of stars are different stages in the evolution of stars. We will see how our sun will become a giant at some point in its future. But to learn how this is done, to learn how stars go through their different evolutionary sequences, we need to determine their masses. It turns out that the mass of a star determines essentially everything about it. In this lecture, I want to show you how we determine the masses of stars and also how we get their ages. Most stars, it turns out, are parts of binary systems. Here's a double star, bound together by gravity. They're going around each other like this, all right? They're not free to roam individually through space. They're roaming through space together. Binary stars. And over 50% of the stars that you see in the sky are actually part of double, triple, quadruple systems like this, even more. Usually they're double stars, but sometimes they have more components. And a famous example is the second star in the handle of the Big Dipper. If you have good visual acuity, you can see that this second star is actually a double, Alcor and Mizar. In fact, they used to be closer together in angular separation, and this was considered a very good test of visual acuity. Now most people with good eyes can see it rather easily, so probably the stars are somewhat farther apart from each other now than they were in the past. Anyway, that's an obvious visual double. You can see that it's a double star. But if you examine those two stars in greater detail, what you actually find is that it's a seven-star system. So around one of those stars, there's another binary, but you just can't see it because it's too faint. And then there's even more stars there. So it's a multiple system. It's actually a seven-star system. And indeed, most of the stars you see out there are at least double stars, if not triple, and so on. Well, Newton's law of universal gravitation dictates the behavior of these two stars. They're bound to each other by gravity. And this law of universal gravitation, together with Newton's three laws of motion, can be used to determine the behavior of the star system. If you know the positions of two stars and their speeds at any one time and the direction of their motion, then in principle you can figure out exactly how the binary will orbit, assuming that there are no influences from the outside changing that orbit. So M1 and M2 are the masses of the two stars. The d is the distance between them, and g is Newton's constant of gravitation. And this is an attractive force holding them together. Okay, well, there are several things that we need to know about such systems. First, each star, it turns out, orbits the common center of mass of the system. The center of mass is exactly like what you get when you balance two balls on a plank that's sitting on a fulcrum. You have to put the more massive ball closer to the fulcrum than the less massive ball in order to have them balance out. We probably, you may have played these games as a child on a teeter-totter or a seesaw, where you put a whole bunch of people on one end and one person on the other end. You find that it doesn't balance too well unless you can slide the teeter-totter around its fulcrum point, the balancing point. This center of mass is actually the point in space about which each star technically orbits. Now, from the perspective of any one star, the other one can be said to be orbiting it. And from the perspective of the other star, the first star is orbiting it. But really, they're both orbiting their center of mass, their common center of mass. And the idea is that the mass of one star times the distance from the center of mass is equal to the mass of the other star times its distance from the center of mass. That's the definition of center of mass. If the two masses are equal, then the center of mass is clearly at the very center, because you need to have equal distances from the center of mass. But if one star is more massive than the other, it must be closer to the center of mass. And an obvious example where this is really quite extreme is the case of the Sun and the Earth. The Sun is so much more massive than the Earth that the center of mass of the Earth-Sun system is almost, but not quite, at the center of the Sun. All right? Okay, so let's consider three cases in somewhat more detail. Here I have stars 1 and 2, both drawn in purple. And in this first example here, I've made the masses equal. So M1 equals M2. The center of mass is always on a line between the two stars. That's fairly self-evident. If the center of mass were out here somewhere, then it really just wouldn't make sense, right? How could that be? You wouldn't be able to balance the balls on a plank if that were the case. The board would be bent. So the center of mass is between the two stars, and each of them orbits around that center of mass. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that the orbits are circular in this discussion. Elliptical orbits are more realistic, but they complicate the situation. They complicate the mathematics, and they don't add any real physical insight. So let's make the orbits circular. So the two stars stay opposite each other, always opposite each other, and always with the center of mass between them. So let's take two stars like this and see how they orbit each other. The center of mass is right between them, and they go through circular orbits of equal size, equal speed. They're equidistant from the center of mass, and the period is just whatever the orbital period is. Okay? So that's a double star system with the stars having equal masses. Now let's consider the central case here in this figure, where one star, M1, is more massive than the other one, M2. The massive one is closer to the center of mass. How much closer? Well, by the same ratio as the ratio of the two masses. If one star is 10 times as massive as the other star, it's 1/10 the distance from the center of mass compared to the other star. So that the product, M1, R1, the mass of the first star multiplied by its distance from the center of mass, is equal to the product M2, R2. That's just always true. That's the definition of the center of mass. So here you can see that this star 1 goes through a small circular orbit. Star 2 goes through a large circular orbit around the center of mass. the two stars always stay exactly opposite each other, so that the center of mass stays fixed. If there are no forces acting on the system, then the center of mass must stay fixed or move with a constant speed through space. That's just Newton's law, that if something is unaffected by external forces, then it either sits there or continues in a straight line motion with a constant speed. Okay, so the center of mass isn't going to go wandering around in some curlicue path. It stays put, and the two stars orbit it. They orbit it with the same period. And since the first star is closer to the center of mass than the second star, it must move with a smaller speed. So let's look at my little demo again. The red star, looking bigger, we will call more massive. And it goes through a circular orbit, but a much smaller circular orbit than the small star, which goes through a big circular orbit because it's far from the center of mass. Okay? And then in the third case, which is analogous to the case of the Sun and Earth, M1, we will suppose, is much, much bigger than M2. These two greater than signs mean much, much bigger. So in that case, the center of mass is nearly at the center of the more massive of the two stars, but not quite at the center of the more massive star. The more massive star goes through a little tiny circle. You can't even see it on this diagram. And the second star goes through a big circle. All right, so it moves with a great speed. And this would be the case for the Sun-Earth system. The Sun stays nearly put, but not exactly in the same place. I'm exaggerating the motion a little bit here. It moves a little tiny bit. If you were to ignore all of the other planets in our solar system and just focus your attention on the Sun and the Earth, you would see the Earth going through its usual yearly big orbit. But the Sun would undergo a small yearly orbit. Same period, but a very much smaller speed and a very much smaller distance from the center of mass. And you can immediately see that this offers a key to the detection of planets around other stars. Because if we are able to somehow detect the tiny oscillatory motion of a star, that could be induced by the presence of an orbiting planet. And that we can use these small oscillatory motions to deduce the presence of planets and in fact figure out even how many planets there are by looking at how complex the motion of the star is. And we'll discuss that later on. Okay, well, let's move on. Here's this double star system. This is a bright one. You can see that the two stars are easily visible. And in fact, if you were to watch them over the course of years and decades, you would find that their relative positions change. This one might move over to here in a decade. This one might move over to there. This is called a visual binary. And by waiting many years, you can plot its orbit. Usually for visual binaries, you have to wait many years before you can tell what the orbit is like, because for it to be easily separated in the sky from your perspective, that means the stars have to be probably pretty far apart from each other. And if they're far apart from each other, they're going to be moving slowly. They're not going to be whizzing around at some huge speed. And so the orbit is only going to very slowly change in the sky. The positions of the stars will only slowly change with time. But there are such visual binaries, and you can see them, and you plot their positions over many, many years, and you can see that they orbit each other. In some cases, one of the stars is not visible. Suppose it's a dim star. Suppose it's a black hole. We'll discuss black holes in a couple of lectures. Then you might see one star moving around in a circle, apparently around nothing else. But we know from Newton's laws that things don't just move around in circles all by themselves. There has to be a force tugging on them. And so one can deduce the presence of another star if one finds one star moving around in a circle or an ellipse or something like that. You can deduce that there must be another star there. So you don't always see both stars. One might be too dim. Here's another way in which you could detect a binary star system. In this diagram, you can see that the two stars are orbiting each other, but the orbital plane is nearly along our line of sight. So, looking at it like this, it's as though one star passes in front of the other occasionally. If the orbital plane is along our line of sight, rather than being more perpendicular to our line of sight like this, then the two stars can eclipse each other. All right, here the orange one is eclipsing the small yellow one. Here the small yellow one is eclipsing part of the large orange one. So through a telescope, even if you can't see both stars separately, you only see them as one point of light because they're too close together, you would detect a change, a periodic change, in the observed brightness of the total system of two stars. Because when they're apart from you, like this, you see the light of one added to the light of the second one. You see the light of both stars as a single point. Okay, they're too far away for you to resolve. But when one is eclipsing the other, you don't see that part of the light. You don't see the star that's being eclipsed. So you have less total light than when you saw both of them together. And then you see them again. And then this one eclipses the bigger one, or part of the bigger one. And again, the light goes down a little bit because you're not seeing that fraction of the eclipsed part of the big star. So if you plot this on this diagram that we have, plot brightness versus time, at point B1, which corresponds to the geometry when you see both stars, this little red one and the bigger blue one, you see the light from both stars, and it merges. They're too close together for you to resolve. But you see the total brightness. Then at point B2 here, the little red one covers or eclipses part of the blue one. And so it blocks part of its light, and the sum of the light from the two stars is therefore lower because you've blocked part of the light. And then as it comes out of eclipse, the light goes back up until you see the total amount of light from both stars, and that corresponds to everywhere in the orbit where you can actually, well, you can't see both stars, but neither of them is blocking the other, all right? So you see the total sum of the two stars, and then the little red one goes behind the blue one, and the little red one is cooler and hence emits less light per unit area than the bright one. So the dip is somewhat smaller in this case, but there's still a dip because you're not seeing the light from this cool red star. And then once it comes out of eclipse, you see the light of both stars again. So this is the light curve, the plot of brightness versus time of an eclipsing binary. And if you see a star through a telescope that goes through such brightness variations, you deduce that it is a binary star, that there are two stars. And these eclipsing binary stars are especially useful because they can be used to determine the relative radii of the two stars by timing how long it takes for one to cross over onto the other. All right. So eclipsing binaries are quite useful, and even more useful, as I'll mention in a minute. And then the third type of binary that's commonly observed is the spectroscopic binary. Remember, there's the visual binary, the eclipsing binary, and now we're going to talk about the spectroscopic binary. And these are by far the most common because getting a spectrum of an object is relatively easy to do, and seeing the shifts that I'm about to describe is quite easy to do as well with a good spectroscope. Anyway, this is a star that appears single, but the spectrum indicates that it's a double star. You might have, for example, two sets of absorption lines moving back and forth as the stars orbit each other. Here I've only plotted one set of absorption lines, but if you have brightness versus wavelength, that is the spectrum of the star, you might see a bunch of absorption lines. And on one night, those absorption lines might fall at the wavelengths that they normally fall at in a laboratory gas. That would mean that the star is at rest relative to you. But what if the next night, the same pattern of absorption lines is visible, but each line is shifted slightly to the blue of its normal rest wavelength? Each one is slightly to the blue. That means that the lines of the visible star, and in this case, though it's a double star system, I've assumed that only one of the stars produces most of the spectrum. The other star might be too dim. It might be a black hole, for example. Anyway, the star, the absorption lines of the visible star are shifted toward the blue. So the star must be coming towards you. And then even later, you might see the same pattern of absorption lines but shifted slightly to the red of the rest wavelengths observed in the laboratory. So you would conclude that the star is moving away from you. What would be happening in that case is that the light is being dominated by one of the two stars, say the red one, and the other star is too dim to contribute much light, but it's got a mass, so it's there. And the red one is orbiting the small one, or more precisely, they're each orbiting their common center of mass. And sometimes the red one is going away from you, so you see a red shift. Sometimes it's going perpendicular to your line of sight, so you see no shift at all. And sometimes it's going towards you, so you see a blue shift, and then no shift. So no shift, blue shift, no shift, red shift. No shift, blue shift, no shift, red shift. And you would see then the absorption lines in that star oscillating around. Let me give you an audible example. I'll be a black hole, so I'm not visible, and there's a star orbiting me quite rapidly, because a black hole makes stars orbit pretty rapidly around them if they're close. And the spectrum of that visible star will be analogous to the audible signal from this little buzzer. And you will hear what happens as the star goes around and around. Actually, I won't be the black hole. My finger will be the black hole, because that's the point around which the star is going to orbit. Okay, so listen carefully. Here's the unadulterated frequency of the buzzer, like that, okay? And now, I know it's annoying, I'm sorry, but it illustrates a good physical principle, so why not? So now let's make it orbit the black hole. Hopefully, you could hear the pitch going from high to low, to high to low, once each cycle, once each orbital cycle. So if I were measuring the spectrum, I would hear a high pitch, low pitch, high pitch, low pitch, that kind of a thing. And I would be able to measure the period over which the pitch completes its cycle, and I would be able to measure the amplitude of the highs and the lows, which would tell me the speed of the star. Because the amplitude, delta lambda over lambda, the amount of shift, is equal to V over C. That's the Doppler formula that we discussed a few lectures ago. So in this case, the one I've drawn in this diagram, only one of the stars is visible. It produces absorption lines. Generally, both stars will be visible. So you'll see two sets of absorption lines, and they will oscillate back and forth. And here in this diagram, you can see then diagrammatically what I just did in this little demo. Here are stars A and B orbiting their common center of mass. When A is coming towards you, its absorption line, whichever absorption line that is shifted toward the blue end of the spectrum. B, meanwhile, is going away from you. If one is going towards you, the other one has to be moving away from you. So its line is redshifted. Slightly later, A and B are both going perpendicular to your line of sight. And so there's no shift at all. The absorption line produced by those two stars is coincident in wavelength. They follow the same wavelength, and there's no shift, no blue shift, no red shift. Slightly later in time, as I change slides here, you can see that now star B is moving towards you, and so its absorption line is blue shifted. And star A is moving away from you, so its absorption line is redshifted. And then, still later in time, A and B are both moving perpendicular to your line of sight, and so there's no shift at all. If we plot the amount of shift as a function of time continuously, suppose we measure the spectrum many, many times per night, we might get a plot such as the following. Plotting the radial velocity in kilometers per second of either star relative to the time in days or in hours, whatever the case may be. You can see the four extreme cases that I showed you in the two previous slides. In case one, A was moving towards you, B was moving away from you. So here's case one. A is moving towards you, so it's blue shifted. B is moving away from you, so it's red shifted. And B is clearly the less massive of the two stars in this example, because B is moving away with a much higher speed than A is moving towards you, right? Remember, when you have two stars of unequal mass, the more massive one moves more slowly than the less massive one. All right? So one star is more massive than the other. When the two stars are going transverse to your line of sight, then their velocities match, and you have point number two here. It's not centered on zero, notice, because the whole system in this example happens to be moving away from you at 40 kilometers per second. That's the whole system moving away. The center of mass of the whole system is moving away. But anyway, relative to the center of mass, they have zero speed. Then the opposite extreme here, A and B, B is blue shifted, A is red shifted. There they are. A is red shifted, B is blue shifted. And then finally, at point number four, there's no shift because the two stars are moving perpendicular to your line of sight. And everywhere in between, then, you have a continuous sinusoidal curve that links those extreme points that I just illustrated. So this would be the radial velocity curve of a spectroscopic binary. Now, these are very important. These spectroscopic binaries allow us to determine the masses of the stars. Actually, what you get in general is the sum of the masses. But if you have an eclipsing binary, you can determine not just the sum of the masses, but the individual masses themselves. And with an eclipsing binary, the nice thing is that you know the inclination relative to your line of sight. It has to be 90 degrees. In other words, the orbital plane is exactly along your line of sight. And so the component of the speed that you see is equal to the total speed of the object. If the stars were at some cockeyed angle like this relative to your line of sight, then you would only observe that component which is radial. You wouldn't observe the component which is in the plane of the sky. So the Doppler shift only tells you the radial component of the speed. If you don't know the inclination a priori, you don't know whether the radial velocity that you're measuring is the full velocity or only part of the velocity, because you don't know the inclination. But if you have an eclipsing binary, then you know the inclination. It's darn near 90 degrees, and so then you can be pretty sure that the total amount of speed that you're measuring is equal to the total speed of the stars. So that gets a bit complex. Just get the general idea that binary stars, through Newton's laws of motion, can in principle give you the masses of the stars. And if you have particularly favorable examples, like eclipsing binaries, where you measure both sets of absorption lines, and you can measure the period, and you can measure everything there is about the system, you get the individual masses. Forget about the details. I just wanted to give you a flavor of how it's done. Radial velocities tell you part of the speed, at least. And if it's eclipsing, then you know that that part of the speed that you're measuring is, in fact, the full speed, because there is no component perpendicular to the line of sight. So the bottom line is that binary stars, and especially eclipsing binary stars, give us stellar masses. And stellar masses are the fundamental, most important things we can know about a star. It turns out that the mass of a star dictates essentially all properties of that star. Other characteristics, such as its chemical composition and other things, are a minor contributor compared to the mass. The mass determines the star's fate, effectively, especially for solitary stars or stars in wide binary systems. The ones that are close together can exchange mass, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But mass determines everything, and it is these binary stars, especially the eclipsing binaries, that give us masses. Okay, well, what do we do with these masses and these luminosities and radii and other things that we've determined? Let's put up a little table here of the properties of main sequence stars. And this is not to be memorized. Don't pay attention to the details. I want to give you a flavor of the range of properties of stars. Going from type O to M, you have the hottest stars all the way down to the coolest stars. All right? That's just what spectral type means. We discussed that last time. The masses corresponding to those spectral types range a factor of something like 1 or 200. Notice that it turns out, empirically, through the study of these binary stars, that the O-type stars, the hot ones, are the massive ones. The O-type main sequence stars are hot. We found that out earlier. That's the definition of an O-type star. But they're massive. They're always massive. An O-type main sequence star is an O-type star because it has the mass that it has, a high mass. Our Sun is a G2 star. It's a pretty cool star, about 5,800 degrees. It has a mass of 1.0 solar masses. That's the definition of the solar mass. By the way, the capital M, followed by a subscript, a circle with a dot in it, means solar mass. The circle with the dot in it means solar anything. Okay? So, the spectral types are correlated with their temperature. That's what determines the spectral type. But really what determines the spectral type is the mass, because the mass is the property with which the star is born. It's not, the temperature isn't what it's born with, in the sense that when a cloud of gas, as we'll discuss later, is contracting, the nature of the cloud doesn't say, all right, well, let's make stars of this temperature and this temperature. What happens is this clump breaks up into a whole bunch of little clumps having a range of masses, and it is those masses that will determine all the other properties of the star. Going back to this diagram, you see that the more massive stars have bigger radii than the smaller stars, than the less massive stars. In units of the solar radius, O-type stars might have 10 or 20 times the radius of our Sun. Our Sun has one solar radius. That's the definition of the solar radius. And then the least massive stars, the coolest M-type stars, have the smallest radii. And they range about a factor of 60 or so. So about a factor of 60 in radius, about a factor of maybe 15 or so in temperature, factor of 1 or 200 in mass. All right, what about this last column here? Luminosity, the power of the stars. L in units of solar luminosities. Well, the Sun is down here at one solar luminosity. That's the definition of the solar luminosity. Look at the O-type stars, the massive guys. 500,000 times as powerful as the Sun. Roughly speaking, 100,000 to a million times as powerful as the Sun. So if you have a 40 solar mass star, it puts out gobs of energy, huge amounts of energy. If, on the other hand, you have a low mass star, an M star, with only 0.2 to maybe half of the mass of the Sun, look at how low luminosity it has. Only about 1% of the Sun's luminosity. So the luminosity is going from the least luminous to the most luminous, span about 100 million in range. Okay? The least massive stars are 1/100 millionth as powerful as the most massive stars. Mass dictates the luminosity. And the more massive stars crush upon themselves more than the less massive stars. They have a huge pressure acting upon the center. And as we will see later, that causes the nuclear reactions in the core of the star to just go, the thing is just sort of really buzzing along because it's trying desperately to hold itself up against this huge pressure. The less massive stars, the very lowest mass stars, they're sort of sitting around. There's not that much pressure on the center, and they kind of gurgle along. The nuclear reactions sort of, titter-tatter along at a slow rate because it's easy for such a star to overcome the weight of gravity of all the overlying layers. Well, we can quantify this in what's called the mass-luminosity relation. Don't worry about the math if you don't like it. I've already given you the gist of the idea. The more massive the star, the greater its power, its luminosity. But quantitatively, the luminosity is proportional to the mass to the fourth power. That means if you have a star 10 times as massive as the Sun, it will be 10 to the fourth times as luminous, the fourth power of 10. So a star only 10 times as massive as the Sun puts out 10,000 times more energy per second than the Sun does. It really pours out the energy. A star twice as massive as the Sun would put out 16 times as much energy per second as the Sun, because 2 to the 4th power is 16. All right? It's twice as massive. Luminosity is proportional to mass to the 4th power. Therefore, it must be 2 to the 4th times as luminous. A lot more luminous, even though it only has a little bit more mass. The consequence of this is severe for massive stars. Massive stars have more fuel to burn, but they burn it at a disproportionately rapid rate. A star 10 times as massive as the Sun has, roughly speaking, 10 times as much fuel to burn, where burning is a nuclear type of burning. I'll talk about it later. But it burns that fuel 10,000 times more rapidly than the Sun, so it uses it up much more quickly. It's like a big, really inefficient gas-guzzling car. It might have a big tank, but if it uses that tank at a disproportionately rapid rate, you'll have to fill the tank more often. Or if you don't like to fill the tank, you go and dump the car if you're really rich. Instead of buying gas, you buy a new car, right? What this means is that in the center of a cluster like this, like the Orion Nebula, where we see lots of really massive stars, these are O stars in here, O and B stars. They're really massive. We know that they formed only a few million years ago. That is a young cluster. How do we know? Well, because if that cluster were 4.5 billion years old, like our Sun, those stars would not be there. O stars and B stars would have burned out in that amount of time, because they're so massive that they use up their fuel, they use up their gas tank really quickly. So the mere presence of those stars in that nebula, of such massive stars in that nebula, implies directly that that nebula, or more precisely, that the stars in that nebula that we see are young. They might be old in terms of their, you know, their own age. They might be about to blow up or something like that. But they're young in absolute years compared with our Sun. How do we know? Because they're massive. And massive stars don't live a long time. Well, this gives us a key then to determining the ages of clusters. Here is one type of cluster called an open cluster. I'll discuss these later in more detail. But you see a smattering, a loose smattering of stars. All right? They're kind of irregularly shaped. These sorts of objects tend to appear in the spiral arms of spiral galaxies. Okay, there's a cluster, there's a cluster, there's a cluster, another one. They line the spiral arms. They sort of almost define the spiral arms. I'll discuss them more later. And then there's another type of cluster called a globular cluster. Here's a globular cluster. A very symmetric structure. Contains hundreds of thousands of stars in the same volume that a little open cluster might contain maybe 100 or 1,000 stars. So globulars are much more compressed than open clusters, and they're much more symmetrical and stuff. Those are the two main kinds of clusters of stars. By the way, these globulars tend to live in what's called the halo of a spiral galaxy, the region out here. This is a spiral galaxy seen edge-on. In fact, it's our own spiral galaxy, seen toward the direction of the center of the galaxy. The globular clusters tend to be out here in the halo. The open clusters tend to be in the plane, in the disk, and especially in the spiral arms. The key point about a cluster is that it formed at the same time, at the same distance, from the same stuff. All the stars formed from the same cloud of gas. They are all of the same initial chemical composition, and they're all about equally distant from you. That's because our distance from a cluster is very large compared to the size of the cluster itself. So the near stars in a cluster are not too much closer than the far stars of a cluster. It's like you're looking at a football game or something from the blimp way high up. All the people are essentially at the same distance. If you were within the stadium, it's not true that all people are at the same distance. The people near you are much closer than the people farther away. But if you're very far away from the stadium, they're all at the same distance. So, since clusters form out of these gravitationally bound clouds of gas, and the clouds of gas are small compared to your distance from you, you can assume that all the stars are the same distance. You can assume that they're of initially the same chemical composition because they formed out of the same stuff. And you can assume that they are the same age, roughly speaking, because this cloud probably collapsed, formed stars roughly instantaneously compared with the total cosmic timescale. Therefore, the only thing that differs initially among the stars that constitute that cluster are the masses of the individual stars. The cloud of gas contracts to form many stars having different masses. Let's assume that initially there are enough stars in that cluster to populate the entire main sequence of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. That is, there are O stars, very massive stars, all the way down to M stars, low mass stars. They all exist in the beginning. Now, clearly, if the cluster only had four stars to begin with, it's a bad assumption to assume that there were O stars and A stars and F stars and all that. But if the cluster has hundreds or thousands or certainly hundreds of thousands of stars, it's a pretty safe assumption that all masses were initially represented. What will happen as the cluster ages? Well, the most massive stars will burn out first. They will use up their fuel before the lower mass stars. And they will turn into something else. We'll talk later on about what they turn into, supergiants and explosions and things like that. But the point is, they leave the main sequence. They burn out their main source of nuclear fuel first. Then the somewhat less massive stars burn out. Then the less massive stars still burn out. And finally, the least massive stars burn out. So if you look at a cluster and you simply chart, measure, what are the most massive main sequence stars? That tells you how long the cluster has been around. How long has it been sitting there aging as the massive stars one by one burn out, like the wick of a candle? Let's look at this. Here is the main sequence initially fully populated from the luminous hot ones to the low luminosity cool ones. They're all there. They're all there. After 1 million years, the big guys burn out. They leave the main sequence. They go off and become giants and stuff. We'll talk about that later. But the point is, they leave the main sequence and they will not appear in this plot. There simply won't be any massive main sequence stars after 1 million years. After 10 million years, somewhat less massive stars will have left the main sequence on their way to becoming giants and things like that. After 100 million years, even less massive stars, lower temperature stars, will have burned off of the main sequence. They'll become giants. Okay? So the main sequence, in a sense, burns down like a wick. It shortens with time, like the wick of a candle. And just like in the case of a candle, if you know the burning rate of the candle, if you know how rapidly it goes down with time, say a couple of centimeters per hour as the wax gets used up, and if you know the initial height of the candle, then by measuring the current height of the candle, you can deduce how long the candle has been lit, because you know the rate at which the candle burns down, and you know its initial height. So if you've got a little short, stubby candle, it means it's been burning a long time. If you've got a big, high candle, it means that it hasn't been burning a long time. So you go and you plot the main sequence of a cluster and you see how long it is. How high up does the wick of the candle go? Or the candle itself go? All right. I kept saying wick, but I meant that the candle size, of course, decreases. Well, you know, if it goes up to here, the thing's 1 million years old. If it only goes down to here, it's 10 million years old. If the candle is burned all the way down to here, it's 100 million years old. If we plot this for a cluster, we can see where the candle ends. That, through modeling, tells us how old it must be. And if we look at a whole bunch of clusters, we find that some are young because their main sequences go all the way up, and some are old because their main sequences stop all the way down here. That is, the candle length is short. We will see that the globular clusters tend to be really old, and the open clusters tend to be young or of intermediate age. But the point of this exercise is that the clusters can tell us the ages of the stars, and hence the age of the cluster itself.